Listeners, welcome to Film Club episode 90. Actually, no, that's wrong. Fuck.
What?
Where did that come from?
Oh, shoddy waddy. Actually, no, that's because we're on podcast episode 90 and I was just looking at the notes.
Right.
Bruh. Hello, listeners, welcome to Film Club episode 23. That's correct, I believe. Yes, that is correct. I am Mal Foster, joined as always by Mr. Daniel Serve. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, Mal?
I'm doing pretty good. We are here this time to discuss your latest pick, which was our very first documentary into Film Club. And my goodness, what a documentary to pick. Highly considered a classic film now, I think it's safe to say. In fact, it's part of the Criterion Collection, which I think, you know, if you're stuck in there, then you've done pretty well. But it's also kind of considered a benchmark and a staple mark for documentary filmmaking as its own subgenre. Again, if, as always, if you haven't yet seen the film, or perhaps you're halfway through it or what have you, then you might want to stop because we're going to probably spoil some things. So if you don't want it spoiled, go watch the film and then come back and join us after you've finished it. But Hoop Dreams, why did you pick this film?
Because I love it, really, to be honest with you. No, I wanted to pick a documentary because, like I said, when I was introducing it on the last Film Club, I kind of feel like we're in a golden age of documentaries right now.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, Hoop Dreams is sort of the watermark. You know, that's the kind of mark that all documentaries should aspire to. It was kind of, I suppose, made outside of that golden era, which I kind of think is, you know, early 2000s to right now. But I just think it's such a great example of, you know, not only documentary cinema, but why documentary cinema can be so affecting and so powerful. Because essentially what this story is, I mean, I think there's only maybe a couple of minutes of actual stock footage in Hoop Dreams. This isn't something that you can kind of script and prepare. Instead, like, Steve James has basically gone out onto the streets and with these characters and in this kind of fly on the wall way, just captured them as they live their lives. And it's such a kind of brave thing to do because you don't know the trajectory that this story is going to take. You don't know where it's going to end. You know, you can't predict the things that happen. You just kind of really kind of hope for the best. And I just think it's amazing that, you know, he's gone with this approach and captures something that's so kind of, there's so many layers to it and it's so powerful and it, you know, it manages to touch on so many interesting things. And that's really why I chose it, because I just think, you know, it's such an interesting approach to filmmaking, one that works so well here.
One of the things that really stands out for me with Hoop Dreams is, with any good documentary, the person that's making it has to be committed to the subject that they're actually talking about. And Steve James spends, like, I'm right in thinking it's a couple of years, basically filming
their
lives.
I think it's 8 years. I'm not quite sure on that. I think it's 8 years. It was at least, you know, in production for 8 years. I don't know if they spent 8 years following the kids around. But it was a long, long time.
Yeah, he spends, well, however many years it is, it's a considerable amount of time to dedicate to any one particular project, but to also just to immerse yourself in someone else's world, you know, to take yourself out of your own world, essentially, and implant yourself into someone else's universe. And that really kind of comes across in the film, generally just because, obviously, you see this overarching story take place and you see changes, but you also get to see a much wider aspect. I mean, granted, the main focus is on Arthur and William, the two young guys that it follows, but it encompasses so much. It encompasses the family members, the area that surrounds them, their history, and it just, it's such a huge kind of encompassing film, yet never really kind of loses sight of its main purpose. And I think that's something really hard to do, but yet it manages to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it is essentially just focused on those two characters, William and Arthur, but, you know, it does encompass so many things. Like, I actually didn't remember how many things it encompassed.
Mm-hmm.
When I introduced the film, I kind of introduced it as this story about these two kids kind of growing up, and it's really not. Like, I forgot so many elements of the film. You know, like, the way it kind of depicts class and the kind of impoverished in the city of, I think it's Chicago that it's set in,
it is,
right?
Yeah,
so it's this kind of impoverished inner city, and then there's also these kind of undertones of the struggles that these kids have because of their race. And there are so many elements to the film, and, you know, it just kind of blew my mind that, you know, Steve James has been able to go out and, you know, obviously he didn't, I don't know if he planned to encompass all these things, or if they just kind of came about naturally. But, you know, it's, I mean, like you said, it's just a testament to his dedication to kind of follow these kids around for so long, and he's able to see, you know, this other side of life that a lot of us maybe aren't familiar with, and, you know, really kind of expose how hard it is in so many different ways to be, you know, a kid growing up in this kind of very poor inner city location.
I mean, I can't speak for him personally, because obviously I don't know, but to me it seems like the way that the film has kind of spread itself out and encompassed so many different ideas. I mean, you talk about race, and which is a really interesting point, especially when it kind of gets to sort of further on in the film, when the young lads are kind of looking towards going to different colleges, and the whole idea of Arthur at St. Joseph's, and that area. I mean, it encompasses so much, but I think it does it in a very natural way, or at least it felt very natural to me, which is interesting because you've seen in the past films that have tried to kind of tap into sort of social, political and ideological ideas and that sort of thematic structure, but have done it in a really heavy-handed way where it's too obvious and it's kind of like they're trying to force the message home, whereas Steve James and everyone involved in the film has just kind of let the film just take a natural shape, and it's kind of just allowed itself to unravel into these areas, and it kind of feels like, yeah, you're kind of getting an insight into what's going on in this particular area on like a larger scale and a more personal scale as the film gets to know the characters better. But it does it in a very natural way. It doesn't feel like it's like, this is what happens, this is what is going wrong, this is injustice. It's like you get to see all of that, but at a casual pace.
Yeah, I think that's just, I mean, that's one of the powerful things about documentary filmmaking, I think. You know, when you have someone writing a script, it's very easy to misjudge the way you handle certain topics or issues or themes, whereas, you know, with a documentary, and especially a documentary like this, where it's very much kind of cinema verite and fly on the wall, you know, it's very easy to just let these subjects kind of, I guess, transpire very naturally, like you said. You know, you don't have this kind of heavy-handedness, or, you know, it doesn't feel like a political film. It feels like a film about two kids who want to play basketball, because, you know, because of who they are and where they live, and, you know, the race and the class and economic status, it just kind of, like you said, very naturally kind of arises from the subject. And, you know, like I said, that's something that's great about documentaries, the ability to be able to do that.
What I think works with this film is that you've seen in the past, and I mean, one of my favourite documentaries of recent times and one of my favourite films of last year was The Imposter, which was, yes, a very kind of different approach to documentary filmmaking. It was almost like a dramatic reenactment, and it kind of had more style and panache to it, and it worked fantastically in its favour. And it has done for other films of that nature, but I think what works well with this is that there is no bells and whistles on it. It's just literally a guy with a camera and his crew and his subjects, and there's little sort of bits and pieces which are cleverly put in. Like, there is a scene at some point in the film where William, who is kind of becoming very deflated because of his injury and whatnot, and he finds his name is taken off the board, and he's talking about that, and then it kind of looks further on at his returning game, and there's just a really simple subtle shot where the camera pans up to see his name is like third from the top on the board.
Yeah, and even though it's not very stylish in a sense, you know, it's one of the things I noticed watching it again this time around is just how well it's edited. I mean, first of all, because I mean, how many hours of footage must have if you've been filming for, you know, this many years? But also, you know, just to be able to, you know, cut together a film that is, I'm trying to explain what I mean by this, but like you say, he's obviously got to know these characters so well, and he's able to kind of capture them at the kind of most kind of intimate moments, and he edits it in a way that, you know, a lot of documentaries don't do, and it's a very subtle way. You know, because you kind of understand the characters as well as he does, through his storytelling, he, you know, can give these very simple shots of, you know, Arthur kind of sat in his room staring kind of despondently, or, you know, just like you said, panning up at a scoreboard, and you kind of feel like you know these characters and what they're going through. And to kind of get that balance between, you know, the actual kind of character development that's on display and the editing, I just think is really, really well done. And, you know, it shows that he's not just a great documentary filmmaker, but I think that's just a sign of a great filmmaker who, you know, really understands the characters and the subjects of the story.
I kind of want to talk about some of the characters, because obviously it follows, as we said, the two main young guys, William and Arthur, but there's so many different characters that come into it. Some are good, some are bad, some are very interesting, I find. I was just kind of wondering, who did you kind of find yourself more attached to, or who did you, I don't know, it's a hard word to say, for root for, I guess. Which characters essentially kind of appealed to you, or...
The characters that I was really interested in, strangely enough, were first of all Curtis Gates, who is William Gates' older brother, and also I think his real name is Bo, Arthur's father, who kind of goes by the nickname Man. And the reason I really like those two characters is because it kind of, you know, the story is very much about this kind of determination between these boys to succeed, and it could be a very quite bleak film and depressing film, you know, because we have said that it does kind of indict a lot of things like race and, you know, the education system and kind of the American economy and the class divisions. But, you know, it is essentially a film that's quite inspirational in a sense, because, you know, you do see these two characters who are so determined to succeed. And Curtis and Bo, for me, kind of represent, you know, these characters who have tried and failed, and are also almost kind of motivations for William and Arthur to really kind of go for it, you know, and to try and really have that drive to succeed. Especially, I really like Bo's character, just because I mean, it feels like if this was a narrative film, it would seem a bit soap opera-y, you know, like the father who leaves and, you know, he gets a drug addiction and abandons his family, and he comes back this kind of changed man to help, you know, raise his son right the second time around. It almost feels a kind of a bit too corny, but because it's obviously real and because it's a documentary, it's really powerful. And, you know, I just, you find yourself rooting for all the characters in a sense, because they are so human and so relatable, and because Steve James is so good at kind of making you understand the world that they live in and the lives and the struggles that they're going to have to suffer through. And I, you know, I find myself at these weird moments of the film where, you know, they have this important shot to make, and, you know, they get it in the hoop, and I almost felt myself like punching the air in like complete joy. It's like, yes, well done. And you really kind of get into both of, you know, the family's lives, and you really do root for both of them, and you want them to succeed.
I think those two characters, I think in general, I think a lot of the male characters outside of the inner circle of Arthur and William are actually really interesting, in the sense that they have sort of multiple dynamics. In a lot of cases, they have a sort of dual purpose, whether or not that's like a conscious thing or it's just something that has happened and I've picked up on it, I don't know. But some of the male characters I find like interesting, like Bo, for example. But, well, both Bo and Curtis have a positive influence on both William and Arthur, in the sense that they are supportive and that they've kind of been where they are at some point. And obviously they are the sort of the product of not kind of fulfilling your dream, as it were. In particular Curtis, because he was a basketball player as well, who never kind of got to go as far as he wanted. And in a weird way, he reminds me, and this is a strange pull, but bear with me, he reminds me of Christian Bale's character, Mickey, from The Fighter, in a sense that he's like a local legend that, you know, will always remain a local legend, you know, but he'll always kind of be overshadowed by a sense of failure, by a sense of bad circumstances.
But it's a really interesting line when he's actually talking about that. It's one that kind of stuck with me after the film, where he says something about, you know, people used to look up to him when he, like, walked the streets, but now, you know, he's just a security guard, now he's nothing, and, like, he kind of wanted his brother to kind of have the success that he didn't have. I just thought it was a really kind of powerful moment in the film.
There's actually a really poignant line that I remembered, which kind of tacks onto that perfectly. You'd think we'd have rehearsed this the way this is going. but there's a line where William, he's right near the end, where William's like, people were always saying to me, you know, oh, when you make it into the professionals, don't forget about me, you know. And he's like, well, you know, that might not happen, so if it doesn't, don't you forget about me. And I think that's actually really poignant, and it kind of shows how, because there is a switch occurs in characters, I think, because at the start, William starts with a bunch of confidence and then kind of ends up deflated and very grounded, whereas Arthur kind of starts off a little bit meek, and it's almost like he has an underdog rising, which I'll get into because that's a whole separate thing. But the whole male aspect is, it's weird because you do have this side of male characters, whether it be Beau, whether it be Curtis, even whether it be Shannon, who was Arthur's friend in like summer school and who came to live with him and whatnot. They all have a positive influence on them in some aspect. You know, they kind of give them motivation, they kind of give them comfort to a degree. But at the same time, there's also a lot of pressure on them from these characters in a very negative sense, because in the sense of Curtis and Beau, essentially, you know, they're kind of living vicariously through their son and their brother, and that puts on so much pressure to them, and it kind of detracts from the positive influence.
It's not something that I actually noticed, but it's an interesting point. I mean, one of the other characters that I really liked, I guess tying into this a little bit, was the first scout who picks up on these two boys playing in like the local on the local like basketball yard or whatever. I know nothing about basketball, by the way. I should probably make this clear at the start. I know nothing about basketball, so if I get all the terminology wrong, I'm really sorry. But he's, you know, he kind of scouts these kids, and you, over the next, you know, 2.5 hours, really see the kind of quite dark kind of underbelly of the kind of scouting recruitment basketball system, and you see how so many kids can kind of get left by the wayside with this. And it's a really poignant moment when they bring that character back in, like towards the end of the film. I mean, he's not been on screen for almost 3 hours, and he's obviously kind of racked with quite a bit of guilt over what he's done in some instances. You know, he tries to justify it to himself, but you can tell that he's in two minds about what he does, because he sees so many kids who, you know, have this kind of false hope and are left, you know, kind of financially crippled and family financially crippled by, you know, this entire system, and broken by the entire system as well. I thought that was a really interesting character, because, you know, there is so much about in the film about, you know, what about the American kind of education system. And again, I know nothing about the American education system, but it seems so unfair. So many elements of the film, you know, that, you know, this, the scene where Arthur's family still have to continue to pay tuition even when he's not there anymore. And, you know, there's so many elements of the film that seem so unfair, and, you know, show how, you know, if you're poor and disadvantaged, you don't quite get the same treatment by the system as other people. I just thought that character tied really well into that theme.
Oh yeah, I think one of the things, I mean, outside of everything else that the film does, something that it kind of really does that I really liked, and again, in a very natural way, it doesn't feel forced down your throat, it doesn't feel like, you know, it's coming with this particular message. Again, it just kind of, whilst the camera's on it and it's seeing everything that there is to see, it kind of shows you just how kind of corrupt the sports system and the education system is. And, you know, you basically see these two boys through the eyes of investors. You know, they are not so much young men in bad areas, but they are potential products, they are potential merchandise, they are potential money makers, basically. And you see that very much so in the case of William, who is the more promising talent, as it seems, and he's kind of picked up and his tuition is paid for. I think it's by the Encyclopedia Britannica company or something.
Yeah,
they basically go, oh well, this kid is good, this kid is gonna make us money, so let's invest in him now. You know what I mean? Let's clear all his money debts and get him the education he needs so he can give us a much larger return. And there's a real sort of sinister sense to it, because you kind of feel pleased for the kid, because he's getting the opportunity to do what he wants to do, to follow his dreams, but he's kind of being used in that sense, and there is a sort of real sort of sinister duality going on there. And similar with Arthur, who doesn't quite fit up to the potential, or, you know, the marketable standards that perhaps investors are looking for when they first have him go to St. Joseph's, and he's cut from the school because of it, and yet he still has to pay. And in a weird way, you kind of feel for both of the characters, but in different ways because of this, because of the ways that they've kind of gone through the system. And like I said before, there's a real switch occurs. Like, you kind of feel like halfway through, when they're both facing adversities, William kind of becomes much more deflated and almost depressed at points, mm-hmm. and you see his love for the game kind of really become extinguished. Like, literally, he just doesn't seem to care that much anymore, and I think he's just been ground up so much by the system and by all of the pressure and everything that comes with it. And he's the way he's handled the adversity that's thrown his way, it's kind of taken him that way, whereas the way that Arthur's handled the adversity, you know, he's been dropped out of this prestigious school, he's still having to pay, he's got the whole thing with Bo going on, you know, who he clearly has disdain for. You know, you can see it in his face. There's several shots where you can just see the absolute disappointment that his father is back and he's trying to kind of clean up his image, and yet he takes these adversities and he kind of uses them as fuel for success, because he really does develop as an underdog. And it's just really interesting as a from a basic human study to see how people who have gone through the same system kind of come out at different ends from the way that they process what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, really say any better than you said it. You hit the nail on the head there. But one of the things that, like, I really liked about the film was the fact that, you know, it's, as it is a film about basketball, I mean, it is a film about basketball, but in a sense, it's not a film about basketball, because there are so many things that about what you just said that, you know, we can all kind of relate to, even I can relate to, despite knowing absolutely nothing about the sport whatsoever, you know, because, like you said, you see William kind of deflated by that whole system. But, you know, it's the same as, you know, anyone who kind of feels deflated because they can't take an exam, yeah. or, you oh, know, exactly. because they can't, you know, get an interview for a college or a university. And, you know, I kind of feel like the whole sports thing is really just kind of a metaphor for a much bigger thing in Hoop Dreams. And, you know, what I wanted to kind of go into was the fact that, you know, I really felt sorry for these kids the whole way through it, because there's so much pressure on them to kind of decide what they want to do with their yeah. lives at such an early age.
Yeah.
You know, I think they're 14 and 13, is it, when the film starts? Something like that.
I think so, yeah.
Maybe they're both 14, I can't remember, but, you know, straight away they're being told, you know, you have to decide, you know, which school you're going to go to and then which college you're going to go to. You know, you need to know what to do with your lives, and this is ultimately going to be, you know, the kind of route that you go down for the rest of your life. And, you know, that whole system is very intimidating and very scary internationally. It's not just an American thing. And so, you know, it's very easy to relate to both Arthur and William as they kind of go through that system, at least for me. I mean, it's something that I really kind of resonated to.
Oh, absolutely, because I think there's a universal thing, like, you're expected to know what it is you want to do at an early age. You're expected to have, in so many circumstances, a clear-cut idea of which direction you want ahead. And, you know, at that age, you know, some people do, and if they do and that works for them, then that's good, you know, but I think that's the rare exception to the rule. I think most people at that age, at like 14, 15, don't have a clue and don't want to have a clue. You know what I mean? You want to just kind of concentrate on being young and kind of enjoying that sense of freedom that you have. Yet here you are, and you, on one hand, you really kind of, you do have this passion for something, but yet you are kind of being forced to apply everything you have, every aspect of your life, to make it work. And that just kind of only increases as you get older and you see it more and you see it more. I mean, an interesting character to bring up is the coach of the St. Joseph's team, Gene, what's his face? I can't remember his surname. But he is very much a constant pressure on William. And there's this interesting thing where, because Isaiah Thomas was like this star pupil who went to that school, he is held up on a sense of idol worship. And you kind of see how much that gets to William, because he is constantly compared to him. He is constantly told, oh, well, you know, you don't want to do this. Well, Isaiah didn't want to do it, but he did it. And look where he is now, you know what I mean? And you constantly see that, and you do feel sorry for them, because, you know, at the end of the day, they're still young men, as talented as they are, and, you know, as much options as they have, they're still young men. And, this, you know, it kind of feels like the pressure that's put on them is detracting from everything that's good about being at that age.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, like I said, it's a very much an indictment of the American education system, the film, because, I mean, in, like I said before, it shows, you know, how hard it is for someone who's disadvantaged or poor to really get ahead in that system. But what it does so well, I think, is really kind of capture, you know, something that's not just, you know, inherently American, it's something that's very universal, which is, like you said, you know, you kind of go into the system and you're told you have to do this and you have to be good at this and you have to be good at that, and if you don't, you're not going to succeed. And just how much pressure there is on, you know, someone who's in school to do this, and yet not really understanding the importance of it. You know, in school, I never understood the importance of, you know, why I had to go to lessons and why I had to get good grades. It's only afterwards you really appreciate it.
Exactly.
And that's something that the film really captures, you know, these two kids who have this real passion and, you know, desire to be basketball players, and yet, you know, over the course of the film, they're just put under so much pressure, you know, both like in academically and economically, and, you know, the whole lives are kind of being molded and they don't realize. And I it's a very inspirational story, don't get me wrong, Hoop Dreams, but I just find that kind of element of Hoop Dreams so tragic, you know, seeing these kids who are so young and so innocent and, you know, just want to be basketball players, getting really, you know, having their dreams kind of broken and destroyed in the sense of, in at least in William's sense, by the whole system.
Yeah, it's almost as if like they just want to play, and the fact that their desire to just want to play is being programmed and scheduled and whatnot, it kind of detracts from it. It becomes more of a system than it does a passion, and it's kind of sad in one sense. But I mean, that's what serves the film so well, is the fact that it is so multifunctional and has these different layers to it. On one side, it is incredibly sad and it is quite tragic, you know, as you see the adversities and you see quite clearly charming, personable young men kind of become deflated and find themselves at fractured crossroads. But yet at the same time, there are moments of just sheer glory. Like I said, Arthur is incredibly so much the underdog. The fact that he's kind of been kicked out, he's kind of been pushed away, told, oh, you're not good enough for this school. Yet he helps take his unranked team all the way to, like, the Chicago State Final. And it's kind of like you have moments which juxtapose that. And it's weird, and it very much, in a weird sense, is a very encompassing vessel of life, where you do have moments of sadness and moments of glory. And I know that's a weird thing to say about a basketball documentary, but I think that's definitely one of the charming appeals to the film, is that it just encompasses so much and it takes you on such a journey in such a simple way.
Yeah, I mean, I love Arthur's arc of his story over the whole film, because he does start as, you know, if you had to kind of look at a start and wonder which one's going to be the NBA pro in years to come, you would think William, you know, he's got everything. Whereas, you know, Arthur's from this very, you know, very much a broken home. His dad leaves, you know, his dad's addicted to crack cocaine. You know, he's failing academically. He's, you know, not performing as well in basketball as he'd hope, but then, you know, he is so kind of driven to achieve that over the course of the film you see him slowly, you know, becomes a star really of his team, and you know, leads them like to success ultimately. And like you said, like, I think that Hoop Dreams, what appeals to me and what I mentioned when I introduced the film last time, was the fact that, you know, it really does kind of encompass, you know, so much about what life is like. You know, you do have these incredible moments of triumph, which are just then become incredible moments of suffering so quickly. You know, it's amazing how, you know, Arthur scores like the winning shot in a match, and then, you know, the next day he's, you know, he's again struggling and faced with new problems and new tasks in his life. And one of the things that I've always wondered about the film is, how does Steve James know where to end this? Especially when you've got characters that, you know, I mean, the lives don't stop when the film ends, they carry on. And I was looking into what happened to these characters after Hoop Dreams, just like in preparation for this. And, you know, both these characters have gone on to have considerable success in their own ways. Neither of them ends up becoming basketball players, but I think one owns some kind of basketball NBA clothing line. I think that's William Gates, actually. And then also the characters of Curtis Gates and Bo both died after the film was made. Were both shot and murdered.
Wow, I didn't actually know that.
And I didn't know that until I read up about it. And you think, you know, this is a film that could go on for another 8 years and show these things. And that's, I mean, that's one of the great things about Hoop Dreams, that, you know, it just does capture so authentically, you know, what life is like.
It kind of poses the question, would you be interested in watching a follow-up? Or do you think the story ends kind of... I mean, it's interesting to kind of read up about those kind of things, but, like... Because, I mean, I don't know if they've actually done a follow-up. I'm presuming that someone has, because the story's so interesting.
I'm sure there's stuff out there, maybe articles, videos that kind of document where they are. I mean, I don't know, because it does come to a very satisfying ending, kind of thematically, I suppose, when the kids kind of graduate. And, you know, it feels like that kind of part of their life is over and are moving on to a new part. But then, on the flip side, they are moving on to a new part, and it'd be great to kind of see, you know, where life takes them after that. It's something that could never end, I suppose. I mean, you could follow William's daughter, and in the post credits it says that Arthur has two kids as well. You could follow this family and this story forever and ever. It could never end. I guess you've just got to find a point as a filmmaker where you kind of think, okay, that's sort of a satisfying ending for what I'm trying to achieve. Which kind of comes with the graduation, but I would like to know, you know, where they're up to now, because you are so invested with them.
Yeah, you are. Well, the interesting thing is, I've just actually seen on IMDb, as we've been talking, there is actually a follow-up documentary called Hoop Reality, which follows Arthur 10 years after Hoop Dreams finishes. It kind of shows the next 10 years of his life.
That'd be interesting to watch.
To be honest, I would. Just out of sheer curiosity, because the thing is, the time you spend with these characters, you go through so much with them. You kind of become frustrated with them, but then you also kind of side with them, and then you kind of have empathy and sympathy, and you go on such a journey with these characters. And to be honest, even if the documentary doesn't turn out to be very good, just out of sheer curiosity, I'd kind of like to see what happened to Arthur.
Yeah, I would too.
And the Yeti that's trying to break into Dan's house.
I have no idea what happened then. I'm really sorry.
Dan is under siege. Perhaps there is a cease and desist from the makers of Hoop Reality saying we're not allowed to plug it. Yeah, so there you go. I mean, is there anything else you want to kind of touch on, talk about the film?
Not particularly. I mean, I just wanted to say how great a documentary I think this is. You know, first time I watched this is the second time I watched it. And the first time I watched it, I thought it was such an incredible story about, you know, just observing these characters and watching them live for 5 to 8 years. I'm really fucking worried about what's going on downstairs. But then, like, there's also so many layers to the film as well that it encompasses, you know, like I said, from, you know, the education system to class to race. And it's just such an amazing achievement of a film to put so much dedication into these characters and kind of make you become part of their family and put part of their kind of closest circle. And, you know, just seeing the way that their lives turn out, it's an amazing achievement, and really an achievement that could only have been made in this format. I don't think you could ever explore this kind of story and these kind of ideas as well in a fiction film or a dramatic film. Mm-hmm. It has to be a documentary.
Yeah,
and that's what I loved about Hoop Dreams.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. I think that's a fantastic closing statement, and we'll leave it at that, because I don't know how we could top that. So yeah, there you go. Hopefully you've enjoyed watching Hoop Dreams as well, and, you know, if you do, check out Hoop Realities, and let us know what you think of that, because the thing is, I'm kind of tempted to watch it now. I must admit, now that I've found out about
it. I am too.
But yeah, no, excellent choice, as usual. You know, I can't say that you've picked a bad film so far. Well, maybe the exception of Breaking Waves. Well, that wasn't your fault. That's all on Lars. I'm putting that all, all firmly on Lars's crazy shoulders. But yeah, and what an excellent first documentary to have into the collection. Which, if you are wondering to know what films have been in, perhaps you were joining us a little bit late. I did tweet this yesterday. It should be yesterday by the time this goes up. Well, I tweeted it earlier in the week at some point, anyway. I tweeted out a link to the list of films that we've had so far, all 22, on the film-centric social network, I guess you would call it, Letterboxd, which if you're not a part of, you should do. You should go join, because both me and Dan are on there, and you can continue your film talk with us further there, if you so wish. But you can also see the list of films in Film Club thus far, all 22, up to date, including Hoop Dreams. But there is going to be a 23rd film added pretty soon. And when I say pretty soon, I mean now, because it is my choice. And I was looking at the list the other day, and I was looking at what we've had, and we've had horror, we've had drama, we've had indie films, we've had foreign films, we've had comedy, we've had sci-fi, we've had a western, we've had a Lars von Trier film, which is its own subgenre in itself, we've had freaky deaky films that make no sense, we've even had animated films, and now of course a documentary. So I was kind of scratching my head thinking, well, what haven't we had yet? And then it occurred to me, we haven't had a war film yet.
Ooh.
So, my choice is one of the most quintessential war films, which is actually, essentially, an anti-war film from the one and only, the master, quite possibly the most gifted man to ever direct a film, Mr. Stanley Kubrick. I am, of course, referring to 1987's Full Metal Jacket.
Nice.
A film that I freaking love. In fact, to be honest, there's something that it is pretty much everything that Kubrick's touched, I will just about, you know, fanboygasm over. But Full Metal Jacket was one of the first films I ever saw of his. And I think that film has got so many, you know, talking of great characters, that film has got so many great characters. And it's got such interesting messages. And it's just, oh, it's just amazing. So I thought, war film, Full Metal Jacket, that's your next one.
I don't think you can do much better than that as a war film. Speaking of war, it sounds like a fucking war zone.
There is, it does.
Podcast. I'm really sorry.
It's quite all right.
But as far as genre goes, you know, and war genre, I don't think you can do much better than Full Metal Jacket. So that's a great choice.
So there you go. That is what you've got to get hold of for the next 2 weeks. Full Metal Jacket. Go get a copy, watch it, and then, of course, come and join us in 2 weeks' time where we'll talk about it. But in the meantime, as I said, if you are not on Letterboxd yet, then do so, because, you know, you can find me and Dan there, and we can talk about films and share films, and it's all good for films and stuff like that, isn't it? As the youth would say. And, of course, you can join us at facebook.com, look for Screen Invasion, and look for the Film Club Forum. Or if you just want a more simple alternative, you can just go to Screen Invasion. .com and leave your comments on either this film or any of the other films that we've watched thus far in the show notes. Of course, we've got the public pick coming up on our next episode, so if you want to suggest a film for us to watch after Full Metal Jacket, feel free to give us your choices any of those ways there that I just said, because I'm not saying them again, because there's lots and it's complicated and I've just messed up. But there you go. So Full Metal Jacket, 2 weeks time. Yeah. Until then, keep on hooping, keep on dreaming, and make sure your door's locked, because whatever's around at Dan's might come around to yours next.